All right. Well, it's that time of the evening. Let's give a warm Tulare County welcome to Diana R. of Hanford.
If you need water, here's water.
Oh, I wish I could drink it. Hi, everybody. I'm Diana, and I am an alcoholic. This is quite a group. Quite a group. Did you all hear the laughter and the kibitzing back and forth? No chairs were thrown. No fist fights. It's my kind of meeting. I love that this is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was an open meeting. I was not an alcoholic, okay? I went because I loved somebody who was an alcoholic, and I didn't know how to save him. And they told me, go to an open AA meeting and see love and joy and happiness and balloons and birthday cakes. And I went, and I was blown away, just like I am tonight, with the enthusiasm and the love that you have for one another and the encouragement. I've been prayed over tonight. I've been slapped on the back. I mean, the encouragement is wonderful. And after the birthday celebration that night, this man got up to speak, and his name was Charlie C. from Southern California. And he had a story like I could not believe. I had never heard anything quite like it. And I thought, oh, my God. But he looked like Mr. Peepers. Has anyone ever heard him or seen him? He's a marvelous speaker. He's funny, and he told the wildest story. And all of a sudden, he started talking about how he felt when he drank and how he treated people when he drank and who he became. And it was like the room scattered, and no one was there but me. And I had some identification, because up until that moment, I would have told you my drinking hurt nobody, because you see, I was a housewife alcoholic, and nobody knew I was an alcoholic. I think I'm the worst kind, because I'm sneaky, and nobody knows why you're angry, and why you're belligerent, and why you're unhappy, and why you cry. So I thought he had a really great message, and I made a decision at that moment that I was going to stop drinking. I didn't hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was in July of 1993, and I went home, and for the next 3 months, I did not drink. So you can imagine how happy I was. On Friday, October the 23rd, I got up that morning, and it was a wonderful morning. It was just a wonderful October morning. You know, I had a great day ahead of me. I was going to play golf. I was going to have lunch with friends. Everything was good. By 8 o'clock that night, I picked a fight with my husband, and by 9 o'clock, I was drunk, sick at my stomach, and I wanted to pass out. And on October the 24th, that's my sobriety date of 1993. And my life changed, because when I woke up that morning, what I saw was a woman dying. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was an alcoholic, and I could not do it on my own. I didn't like who I saw, and I really did want to die. And I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in my head, and that was to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, of which I did. And what I loved in the beginning when I heard at my first meetings was I heard these three things. I heard about the mental obsession. I had no idea. I heard about the craving. I heard about the phenomenon of craving. And you know, I felt like I breathed for the first time. I thought I was bad. I thought I was wrong. I did not know that I had a phenomenon of craving. I did not know. I had no idea that once I picked up a drink, I had to pick up another one. I had no idea that alcohol became my way of coping, my solution to my life. And I heard the message. I continued going to meetings, and I got drier and drier and drier, because that's all I was doing, is going to meetings. And don't get me wrong, I love meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they're the bomb. I really do. But that's not where I get recovery. I get fellowship. I get to hear other people's stories. I get to hear some recovery. But what I knew is I was miserable, and I was missing something. And this woman stopped me after a meeting, and she said, Diana, why don't you look for the similarities instead of the differences? My very, very next meeting was a third tradition meeting, which said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and I belonged. I owned that seat. I ended up getting a sponsor, not because I wanted to, so don't think getting a sponsor is fun. You know, it's not. She was not fun, not a fun sponsor. Her first words to me was, you do not need to do step one with me because I've heard you in meetings and your life is already unmanageable, so let's go on to step two. Here's the miracle of this, having this sponsor. You don't need to like them. Really, you don't. But I know that she saved my life because what she said is, there is a God and you're not it. So I'm going to ask you to go home and get step two out of the dictionary, and I want you to define every word in step two. And then what I want you to do is I want you to make a list of every quality you want in that God, your higher power, whatever you choose to call. Because she said you're going to need those qualities in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can sit here and tell you, I can stand here and tell you, that that is the foundation of my recovery, that step two. Because if you're alcoholic and you want to get better and you want to lead a different life, whether you're 3 days sober or 12 days sober, we've all been, us alcoholics in here have all been 3 days sober, 12 days sober, 30 days sober. We just keep doing it. So if you think that you're new and you have nothing to share, that's wrong, because we all know how you feel. You know, I'm coming up on a birthday and I'm reflecting back to who I was and how I got here and who I am today. And I want to tell you, when I heard that this day was about working the steps and it was a workshop on the steps, what I want to say is, how lucky are you? How lucky are you to be here and have people who love the steps and want to show you about the steps? The steps are the only thing that, in the God of my understanding, okay, sponsors, who have given me this life and shown me the way. And early on, I heard this gentleman talking about his toolbox. And he said, I have this toolbox, and I, an Alcoholics Anonymous, as a sober member, get to decide what I want to put in my toolbox. It could put a big book, it could be the steps, but we never have to be far away from any of the steps. I've had four sponsors. I only let go of one. The other ones moved away from me. I took it very personally. But she was Zen. And I'd love Zen people, but not to be my sponsor. Because she would say, I would go to that woman like my hair was on fire and I didn't know what to do and I couldn't pick up a step and I couldn't pick up the phone and call anyone and I couldn't go to a meeting because you would all know I was crazy. And she would say, well, Diane, just pray about it. Just pray about it. You know, and she was that Zen. And I just felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. So I found a sponsor who has the same personality as I do. She's crazier than a loon. And I've got more sobriety than she does. But you know what? She has something that I want. And here's the miracle of keeping coming back and having that sponsor. I now call that sponsor every week, and she calls me every week. We call to chat. We call to see how each other is. And so we've started that. We've got that bond with each other so that we can call each other when things are good. And when things are not quite so good, I can call her and I can tell her what's going on, and I'm not embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed because she loves me. She knows me. I know her. And so if you have a sponsor in name only, shame on you. Get a sponsor that you call. You know, pick up the phone, call. Get a sponsor that you say, when are we going to meet next? Get a sponsor. You say, what step are we going to work? Or she can say, what step are you working? You know, because I'm telling you, life goes by fast when you're sober. You know, and I thought the first time I had the problem in sobriety, I went to that sponsor and I said, I don't understand it. I'm working the steps. I'm sponsoring women. I'm good. I'm not drinking. And she said, get over it. You know, this is life. You're getting the tools now that you can go through anything. You can go through anything. Real short story here. You didn't tell me when my 10 minutes was going to be up. Shame on you. It's your fault. I haven't lost that character defect, blaming. This year, I went to a retreat and it was on step 3. And I've had an issue in my life that I've not been able to get out of. And I came home from that retreat and I started saying that third step prayer. And I kept on asking God, what is that bondage of self? What is it that I can't see? And this issue's been with me for a lot of years. And I'm in a place now where I'm ready to be free. You know, I heard it tonight. I'm free. And so I kept on asking God, what is it that I can't see? And you know, that first sponsor that I was telling you about, she had me name my character defects. She had me describe them. So when I'm in that defect, I know what they look like. And I owe amends to Bill because one of those defects came out when he asked me to lead the meeting. My defect of fear came out, and I acted like that whiny little girl. And she is such an embarrassment to me. And what I wish I had said to you is, Bill, thank you for allowing me to speak in front of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you. Because you know what I really want to do is I really want to give back to what I've been so freely given. So anyhow, I kept on saying that third step prayer. And one afternoon I was laying down and I saw 6 of those character defects coming after me. And I named them. I'm not going to name them to you because I really don't want to embarrass myself any more than I already have. And what I saw is I had been holding on to 6 of those defects because they were serving me well for so many years. And I did not even know that they were there. And once I could identify what those defects were, I call them coping skills now, I've been set free. The same incident, the same things that are happening to me that have happened to me for a lot of years. Those character defects visit me, but they don't stay. You know, I really am very happy. I really am. And that's what I think every woman sitting and man sitting in this meeting deserve, is you deserve to be happy. But it's work. It's a lot of work. And the women that I sponsor, I say, I will never tell you this is easy, but the reward is so amazing. And you know, having that higher power, having that God, that personalized designer God, has allowed me to have this life that I never imagined that I could have. I don't have the cars. I don't have money. But, you know, did you ever feel like when you were drinking there was something missing? There was just something inside of you missing and you couldn't pinpoint it? Well, what I know it was that connection with my God. Not his God or their God, but when she told me I could have that designer God, it became my personalized God, my higher power. And you know what? Life happens. But you know, I always got that designer God to go to. And you know what? The first thing I had to have that higher power have was a sense of humor. You know, because when I lost my sense of humor and I started taking life so seriously, alcohol was the only solution I had. And I was not funny then. I love you all. I really do. And I want to thank Boo and the committee for all your hard work that you've done. I mean, this dinner is amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. I want to thank everyone who's written or called or done all of the paperwork or the finances for the meeting. That can be daunting. And I just want to thank you all for showing up and being here. And I hope you have a great night. Thanks for letting me share.
Let's give it up for Diana one more time. All right, we have a special treat tonight. We've got a special visitor that has 40 years of sobriety. He's come a long way, came all the way from Las Vegas to see us. So let's give a Tulare County welcome for Bob D. from Las Vegas.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic. And I'm sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, but I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of trying to forget ourselves and help others. Consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. It's my personal best, actually. I want to thank Bill and the members of the committee for I've been treated very, very, very well since I got here, and I know where I came from, so I still have remnants and memories of what a parasite I was at one time, you know, and what a horrible human being. And so it always touches me when people are nice to me, you know, and treat me well. I immediately lose respect for them, but I appreciate it. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. I want to welcome all the newcomers. Glad you're here. Oh, especially the three gals that got the books for being the newest people. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Where else on the planet would you get a prize for recently burning your life to the ground? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great, I love AA. It's the only place in the world where you come in a big shot and work your way up to servant. You know what I mean? I really enjoyed our 10-minute speaker. And I was, you know, as they were doing the readings before the meeting and the H&I and the Seventh Tradition stuff, I was very impressed with that. That's real AA stuff. And the format that they read at the beginning of the meeting is the exact same stuff we read at my home group. It was written by my sponsor in early 1963 when he started a group called the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. So I was there this Wednesday night. And there's groups all over the world. There's groups in other countries that use that format. And it's an amazing format. I had dinner with my sponsor. I have a sponsor, and he knows he's my sponsor. That's very important. If your sponsor is not sure he's your sponsor, he's not. And I had dinner with him, and he was picking on me a little bit. His light's getting dimmer. I used to like it when he'd pick on me a lot. And I knew that he loved me, and he'd make fun of me, and I liked that. And if it's, you know, there's an old saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, let us love you till you can love yourself. I don't think that's it. That's not it at all. Let us make fun of you until you can make fun of yourself. That's really it. When you can start to laugh at yourself, man, you're free. Do you know the word humor and the word humility come from the same root word? It's the word for earth, humus. And that's next to my sobriety and this intermittent freedom from the bondage of self. I think the greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is a sense of humor. And I just love that. We laugh a lot. I run around with a pack of crazy guys that we all do service together. We do lots of H&I meetings every week, and we laugh a lot. And sometimes other people don't know what we're laughing at, but we do. I have alcoholism. I suspect I may. There's no way to know you have alcoholism until you drink, and to see if you have that allergic reaction to alcohol. But I suspect I was, before I ever picked up a drink, I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. You know what I mean? Because I wasn't right. And you know what you know that when you take your first drink and you go, Oh, yeah. Like, where's this been? Where's this effect? You don't even know that you don't feel good until you really feel good. And, man, I remember the first time I ever got lit up, I was almost 13 years old. I was hanging around with a bunch of older kids. I was coming from behind, trying to pretend I was tough, trying to pretend I wasn't afraid, trying to pretend I was cool, trying to pretend I fit. And it was, and the facade was crumbling. And I walked around with that anxiety about being found out. You know that feeling like when you're phony and you just that somebody's going to look and see right through you. That you're just phony. That you're not really tough. You're not really cool. You don't really fit like you want everybody to think you do. You're not okay. And I tell you, that facade was crumbling. And the first time I ever drank alcohol, I didn't have to pretend anymore. I really did fit. Fit. 5 drinks in, I was their freaking leader. You know what I mean? I was like, it was amazing. I could come out and play. I was bright. I was funny. I'm not funny sober. I'm a mope. She get me half drunk. I crack me up. I'm funny. Get me half drunk. I can dance. I can't dance sober. I go to those junior high school dances. If I was sober, man, I'd stand against the wall, just like. Just get me half drunk. The rhythm of the universe flows through me. I can dance. I don't mean to be crude, but if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd probably be celibate to this day. I mean, who? I couldn't walk through the fear of even asking somebody out. You know what I mean? I'm too hyper self-conscious. Alcohol set me free. And I loved it. I didn't know what it did. I was sober. It's funny. It did it for me. It did it for me. It did it for me. And then until it started to turn on me. And I never understood what it really did for me until I was sober a number of years. I realized what it really did for me truly was that it relieved me of the bondage of self. I could walk into a party or a bar and just be locked up inside of me. I can't talk to anybody. I got me right on me. And I don't feel good, and I don't like, I'm glaring from deep inside of me. I'm glaring out at the people. And 5 drinks. 5 drinks, and well, I don't even, oh, that's all gone. 7 drinks, and I'm saying things to people like, I love you, bro. You know what I mean? Get connected. Connected. I'll die for you, man. No. And I felt that intimacy. That the book says, joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. And alcohol was magical like that. My parents would look at me, because they're not alcoholic, and they'd wonder why I drank the way I drank. Why do you have to destroy yourself? Why do you think, why can't you just have a couple? But see, if alcohol did for them what it did for me, they'd understand exactly why I drink the way I drink. But alcohol doesn't do that for them. It doesn't do that for my sister. It doesn't do it for my daughter. I had some uncles. They did it for it, and they died of alcoholism. But my immediate family, I didn't grow up around alcoholism. And yet, I had it. I had a bad case of it. And from the very first time I started to drink, it hooked me. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I remember a feeling and the first time I ever had that amazing buzz where I'm one of the guys, and this is, oh, I remember thinking to myself, I want to feel like this the rest of my life. And I tried. And I'm an alcoholic, and I had a lot of other problems. And if you're one of the new people here, you probably have a lot of other problems. You probably have money problems. You probably have relationship problems. You probably have depression problems, anxiety and worry problems. You might have drug problems. You might have gambling problems. You might watch porno and you end up in the burn unit. I mean, you might have a whole bunch of problems. But if you're alcoholic, King Alcohol encompasses everything. And this is not a drinking problem. This is a terminal, fatal illness. And how do you know if you got it? Well, if you're an alcoholic, alcohol does something for you that it only does for alcoholics. It relieves you of the bondage of self, lets you come out and play, it sets you free. Not at the end. Wilson uses the analogy of a boomerang that takes majestic height and then comes back and cuts you. Alcoholism is a progressive illness and it turns on us eventually. But in the beginning, spectacular. But alcohol also does something to me that it only does to alcoholics. And what is that? It gets me drunk, gets me a DUI, gets me in trouble, makes me say stupid things. Well, it may or may not do those things. But it's one thing it always did for me. As I would drink alcohol and the effect would start to hit me, I would break out in an irresistible yearning for more. I never didn't have that reaction. I was 10 years sober, probably. And I heard a speaker talking about drinking normally and socially for a few years and then crossing over some line into alcoholism. And I remember thinking, did I do that? Did I ever drink and not have that allergic, to never not have that? And I was searching back through my past just for one or two, maybe just even one. One time, just one time, when I'm at a party, maybe doing lines, smoking a little reefer, drinking some wine, or maybe at the bar shooting pool with my buddies, doing shots and beers. When was the time when after an hour of that, and someone said to me, hey, Bob, can I buy you another one? When was there ever a time where I looked at him and said to myself, no, I'm good here, thanks. I couldn't find one time. Not one. Matter of fact, I'm the guy, if I'm at your house, and this happened to me on a couple occasions, many occasions actually, and we're drinking, and oh, it's bad when we're drinking beer, because beer lights the fuse, but it doesn't start the fire enough. You know what I mean? Beer's like, it's not like vodka. My favorite was 151 rum. 151 rum gets you downtown now. I love 151 rum. If there's any 151 rum drinkers here, I got to tell you something. There is no social drinking of 151 rum. I mean, you drink 151 rum to get there, wherever that is. And I love that stuff. But sometimes I'd be at somebody's house and we're drinking beer, or maybe we're drinking for a while and it's gone. And I lived in a state that was cruel. You couldn't buy nothing on Sunday. Bad deal. And the liquor stores would close at like when it starts to get dark. And not open till like 10 a.m. This was a bad place to live. Because I'll tell you, you wake up, you come to at 4 a.m. and you need a drink, you're going to pace for a while. And I'd be at somebody's house, and we'd run out, can't get no more. So you know what I do? I go to your medicine cabinet. I use your bathroom. I start going through the cabinets. I'll just start taking stuff. Sometimes if it said, do not operate heavy machinery, I get excited, right? If it says, this may cause anxiety and sleeplessness, I get a different type of anxiety. I was excited. Sometimes I just take stuff. I don't even know what it is. I don't even care. I'm just hoping for something. Because I got the alcohol I've been drinking has set off the allergic reaction and the phenomenon of craving. I got the more thing going on, more. And so I took some speckled capsules, took a bunch of those one time. It turned out to be Dexedrine. I was up for almost a day and a half. We were going to change the world. I had plans, and we were going to, it was amazing. I took some other pills. They were but it turned out to be some kind of barbiturates that turned my leg to rubber, and I was just like falling around. And I took some stuff one time, and all it did was make me super regular. Jesus. Oh. I I ate all the pills off a wheel one time, found out later, no chance I'll be pregnant in my lifetime. Man. And why am I doing that? Because I'm a pill head? No, because I got alcoholism and I have an allergic reaction to alcohol that only occurs in people with alcoholism. Those other people aren't in the bathroom eating the laxatives and the birth control pills. I mean, they're not doing that. Huh? But that's what I do. It sets me off. And it only occurs in people with alcoholism. You know, treatment centers confuse me because they'd say things to me like, well, what's your drug of choice? what do you got? I mean, you know. I mean, I've drank vanilla extract. I drank cough medicine. I broke open a magic marker in prison one time and toughed it, hoping some crap would happen, you know. What they should ask is, Bob, what happens to you when you drink alcohol? What happens to you? Are you able to pass the test? The self-diagnosis test on page 31 of the big book. And it says something, this is if you're new here and you're not sure, maybe you have a lot of other problems, depression problems, gambling problems, drug problems, and you're not sure if you're an alcoholic. The book says you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room, try to some controlled drinking. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. And it says you might need to do it more than once to get a true knowledge of your condition. Well, if you're like me, and you got the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and you don't know it, and you're going to take that test to see if these people in AA are full of crap or not, I don't think I have that phenomenon. I don't see no phenomenon of craving. All right, I'm going to go over here. I'm going to have two drinks, just two, and shut her down. And since it's only two doubles, and then shut her down, and then you got to go home. Now, you can't smoke nothing, take no pills, nothing, two drinks, that's it. Well, when I start the second drink, it'll become very clear and very apparent to me that this is a bad test day. Because that game's on. Who knew? Who knew that game was on? Oh, my God, I can't leave now. Some girl would come in, and I'd think, oh, look at her. Oh, I've got to have a drink without her. Well, I've got to have a drink with her, man. I think, God, if I get with her, I think pigeons would fly out my ears. I've got to have a drink with her. Joe would come in. Joe's always got something good to smoke or something going on. Joe's always got something cool going. I've got to have a drink with Joe. Bad test day? Tomorrow would be a better test day. And if I took the test again tomorrow, the same thing happens. And I don't know it's an allergic reaction to alcohol. I don't know it's a phenomenon of craving. To me, internally and experientially, it just seems like I got more information and changed my mind. And I had no clue that this is an allergic reaction to alcoholism, and the manifestation of the allergy is this craving, this yearning, this more. I had that. Always had it. I had it my first drink. I had it my last drink. But what started happening to me, in the progressive nature of the disease, as things got worse for me and worse for me, I started losing everything. I started losing friends and... I started, my mother and father loved me, and they spent a fortune trying to help me. And I eventually hurt them so often and so much that after a while, to save their marriage and their own sanity, they had to have nothing to do with me. And it wasn't because they didn't love me. I was just making them insane. One of the things I did to my mother and father, I played on their love. And I would keep getting back up on my feet again. And every time I get back up on my feet again, they'd get hope because they loved me. And they'd start trying to help me again. And then just about the time, it was always like this too, it was crazy. Just about the time when they're starting to think, oh, Bob's going to be okay. Bob's turned the corner. Bob's all right now. That's the time I'd pick up a drink and burn my frickin' life to the ground. I'd steal from them again. I'd disappoint them. I'd lie to them. I'd hurt them. again. And that was the worst thing I ever did to them, is I kept getting back up on my feet, getting their hopes up, and then dashing their hopes one more time. And until they couldn't take it anymore, and they literally cut me out of their life. I remember I was in a detox. I was sick too. I had broken rib, and I used to get in fights in bars. I get this thing with me. I about the time where I'm so brave I can beat anybody in the bar. That's also the time I've lost my coordination. Yeah, it's a bad dynamic. That's a bad combination right there. You know, I got beat up a lot, and I run my mouth. I'm thinking I'm a tough guy. Oh man. And they come into this. I'm in the hospital, and I got me on an IV, and they got my I'm taped up and. I'm sick. They came in and demanded their house key back. And they told me, you come to our house, we're going to have you arrested. And don't you call us. I didn't think they meant it. I thought, eh. Well, not too long after, I ended up in jail, which is frequent for me. I don't end up for anything gangsterish. I mean, I fancied myself a gangster one time, but the police told me I was a public nuisance. I end up in jail, and I couldn't get out. You know, I'm stuck, and I'm going to be in there for a while. And my dad had the ability to pick up the phone. He was like very connected, and he could have picked up the phone and got me out of there. So I called him, and he hung up on me. Oh man, there's nothing worse than a self-will run riot, egocentric alcoholic with no self-esteem getting thwarted. Oh man, I was just mad. So I knew the soft spot was my mom. So I wrote my mom a letter. And I pulled out, I pushed every button I could put. That letter, I told her I loved her. I understood why she won't help me anymore, and it's okay. I've tried to be a good son, but I'm just too good at being bad, and I'm sorry, and it's okay. And I got raped by 10 guys last night, and I'm going to hang myself tonight in the prison. But don't worry about me, Mom. I love you. And she still wouldn't bail me out. Oh, man, I was mad. I was furious. I remember I was a year sober, make my first face-to-face amends with them. I started to mention that letter. They did not want to talk about that letter. Oh, man. So they cut me out of their life. But according to my sister, they couldn't cut me out of their heart. So my mother, who was a therapist, my parents were very altruistic, was now seeing her own therapist and taking medication to live with the anxiety about me, even though they wouldn't have anything to do with me. And my dad was sleeping like 15 hours a day. And they no longer went out of the house. And that's really sad because they had been very community-oriented people. My dad had been the president of the Lions Club. My mother and they belonged to the country club. They were in all kinds of charity stuff in the community. My mom was junior league, women's club. They just, they were really community-oriented. Last couple years, I drank. They never left the house because they were just sick and tired of people asking them about me. And I'd tell anybody that listened to me, I didn't hurt anybody except myself. Man, is there a delusion? Is there a level of self-delusion and selfishness greater than that? You know, I stole so much in the years I could get into their house from my parents that my dad became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop and the guy in the town we live in from buying his own crap bag, right? But I don't hurt anybody except myself. And my drinking started as it always does. In late stage alcoholism, some horrible things started happening to me. And it's not the external consequences that break us and bring us to our knees. It's the internal ones. And what had happened to me at the end is I my sponsor refers to it as getting to a place where there's no friendly direction, not even in the bottle. And somehow, along the line, slowly but finally, alcohol had completely turned on me. At the end of my drinking the last couple of years, I'd drink in depression. I would drink in horrible, horrible feelings of loneliness. That sometimes if I could get to a phone, even if it was 4 a.m., I'd have to call people. I just was so lonely. I remember calling an ex-girlfriend about 4 a.m. and waking her up. And the minute I heard her voice on the phone, I started to cry. We should have got married. And then her husband gets on and threatens me. Jesus. And the loneliness is so hard to live with because alcohol, at one time, it connected me to life and people, and I felt like a part of, and now it somehow has turned on me, and I feel even more pathetically alone and lonely when I'm drinking. And I don't understand what's happened to me. See, I could remember, I couldn't duplicate the effect produced by alcohol. And I'm a funny guy because I started in 1971 as a young kid. I wasn't old enough to take a legal drink. I was made to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I thought was the lamest thing I'd ever. Oh, it was offensive to me. All these old, I mean, these are like Lawrence Welk watching people, you know. Oh my God, they're just, this is worse than Amway. I mean, this is bad. I mean, this is like, what's worse than church? Oh, lame people, happy, clappy, grateful for everything people, you know. I'm not an alcoholic. I might have admitted, you know, in the beginning of chapter 3 it says most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I refuse to be an. I am not an alcoholic. Book says by every form of self-deception and experimentation, try to prove ourselves exceptions to the rule. I think all my drug use was to that end, to buy me periods of abstinence, to manage the hangover. So I did the stimulants, so I don't black out. The problem with stimulants, you don't black out, but then you remember all that stuff. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict. I mean, that's kind of cool. There was rock stars I looked up to that were professed drug addicts. That's kind of hip, really. I'll be a mental health case even, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of those. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. I had uncles that were alcoholics. They're pathetic. They're obnoxious. They're just everybody talks crap about them because everybody, and the whole family thinks they're stupid, right? I don't want to be an alcoholic. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And the longer I argued with the reality, the truth about me, the sicker I got. And it's a terrible thing, you know. It's like you can't, you get to a place where there's no relief, there's no hope anywhere. Abstinence was brutal for me. I couldn't take it very long. It felt like I was doing time. I get so depressed when I get sober. I get full of anxiety to the point where I feel like I'm having a nervous breakdown. And I don't fit anywhere sober. I remember going everywhere I go, and if there's bunches of people around, I always get that horrible feeling of separation, like it's all of you and then there's me. And I try to stay sober, and I might take a hostage. You know, find that girl that's so pathetic and insecure in treatment that she's so desperate to be with someone. And you know, if you hook up with her, she's too insecure to ever leave you. So you just take her as hostage, and treat her like you would treat anybody that would love someone like you. You treat them like crap because you hate anybody that would love someone like you. You know, that's a problem. If you love me or even not, you like me, I just, you're immediately below my standards, for God's sake. I mean, want to grow with taste and discernment. So the loneliness, I think, is in our book says that we will know a loneliness such as few do. We'll be at the jumping off place and we'll wish for the end. And that's at the end of my alcoholism, that's exactly where I was. I couldn't live with it, not the way it had become because it had turned on me. It was horrible. And yet I can't live without it because it's not just that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I got an abnormal reaction to abstinence. I don't do well sober. I mean, I could get like a mule in a hailstorm and hunker down and take it for a while. But eventually, I just get to a place where I am consumed with this yearning and this feeling of, and this imagining that I can still party like I did when I was 20 years old. I'm chasing the ghosts of parties past. Right? The problem is they're ghosts. You never catch it. And I in 1977, I ended up in an emergency room. I do that on a regular basis. Emergency rooms and county jails, you know, just short term. But I end up in this emergency room. I hurt myself sometimes, or I get in fights, or people hurt me, or car acts, all kinds of stuff. This particular time, in some kind of drunken rage, I put my fist through a plate glass window, and evidently I wouldn't stop bleeding, and some people were scared for me and took me to this emergency room at this hospital. And of course, they stitched me up and they gave me some x-rays to see if there's anything damaged. And so I'm sitting in the waiting room in the emergency room, and I've been in there. Now, I've been in there by now. It's been about 2 hours. And, you know, it's an odd thing. They do not have bars in emergency room waiting rooms. I mean, if they ever needed one somewhere, that they need one there. And the effect of the alcohol is wearing off. So I'm kind of in there a couple hours. I'm starting to sober up a little bit, which is, I don't like that. And there's a rack. I'm still waiting. I got to wait for this results of these x-rays. And the doctor let me go. And there's a rack of medical pamphlets, like stuff like heart disease, diabetes, various things. And there's one, it said something like the 7 warning signs of cancer. Now, I don't know why I pulled that one out of the rack and started looking through it. I started thumbing through it. I'm just nervous, thinking, I don't know, I was waiting for so I can get out of here so I can get something to drink. And there's this, I read this thing. It's one of the warning signs was something like unexplained intermittent bleeding. I remember reading that and thinking, I dry heave sometimes in the morning when I'm sick, and sometimes there's blood sometimes. Matter of fact, I thought about it a little more, and I thought, there have been a couple times I've been bleeding out of both ends. I thought, oh my God, I have terminal cancer. I have terminal cancer. And then I thought, wait a minute. Oh my God, you know, the blackouts and how I fly off the handle at people for no reason. I emotionally roller coaster. I don't fit anywhere. I'm so depressed. I'm like almost catatonic from depression. It's metastasized to my brain. I have a brain tumor. And it explained my whole life pretty much. And I just, oh man, I just love, I'm sitting and thinking about the brain tumor. There were times I swear I could feel it growing. Yeah. And I had this fantasy. I love this fantasy about, you know, one of these days they're going to find me and take me to a cancer ward. I'm going to have to notify my mother and father, who have nothing to do with me because they think I'm a loser and a bum, and they're going to realize how wrong they had been. They're going to come running to the hospital. And then they're going to tell all my ex-girlfriends who thought I was a bum, and they're going to come running to the hospital properly ashamed of themselves. Oh, I love that brain tumor. ended up in another detox. And, you know, the medical guys, they always interview you. And they're, you know, check your vitals and all that stuff. And the guy starts talking about alcoholism. I said, Doc. Doc, I have a terminal brain tumor. And he looks at me and he rears back a little bit. And he says, has that been verified? I said, yeah, well, yes, it has. Yes. Well, it's verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me, right? And he set me up with a whole series of tests. They shot dye in me. They put me in a tube. They did blood work. They did all this stuff. I'm waiting for my redemption. I know I'm going to die from the brain tumor, but that's all right because I'll be right and they'll be wrong. And he calls me in and he says, you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have cancer at all. All we could find was a small ulcer and a small hemorrhoid. And I was depressed. I wanted a second opinion. He was happy. The doctor is happy. Oh, you're going to live. It's great. You don't have cancer. I'm depressed, right? How sick do you have to be that you would rather die and be right? Right? What kind of ego do you have to be to have in order to, that you don't care if you're going to die as long as you're right? Right? Well, he did say one thing that stuck with me. He said, kid, you don't have, what you have is alcoholism. And you keep drinking, it's going to kill you, but you're a young kid in your 20s. It's probably going to take 5 years. And not too long after that, I got thrown out of another treatment center I was in, and I'm facing 2 years in prison, and I'm totally alone, and I can't. I'm sitting in the park one morning, and I don't even know how long I've been on this run, and I'm shaking terrible. I got terrible shakes. My nerves are shot. I got sores because I don't eat. My gums bleed. I'm not against eating. It's just that if it comes down to McDonald's or a half gallon of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, McDonald's loses every time because I need the medicine more than I need the food. And I'm just sitting in that park, and I'm thinking about what that. It's horrible because there's no relief in the bottle anymore. It's become pathetic and depressing drinking. And I remember thinking about what that doctor said. Yeah, it's going to kill you, kid. But it's going to take 5 more years. And something inside me. I thought, oh my God, I can't do five. I can't do 5 more weeks of this. And I don't think I'm that much different than a lot of late-stage alcoholics. We're sort of hell-bent to drink ourselves to death anyway. The problem about drinking yourself to death, it takes a long time. It's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on. You know what I mean? That's why so many of, I bet you if I asked for a show of hands, I bet you a bunch of people in this room had thoughts about killing themselves. Because you're in a trap you can't spring. Drinking has become horrible. Horrible. And abstinence is depressing and lonely and horrible. And you don't see a door number 2 or door number 3. And some of you are probably sitting there, well, what about AA, Bob? Well, the problem with AA, if you ever come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came to probably 150, 200 meetings in those almost 7 years I was in and out, and a couple things are very apparent to me. I'm messed up and I'm dying here, but I listen to you and I look at you and I get real clear that whatever's wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. Because look at you. You're happy and grateful and, oh God, you love everybody and Jesus. You ever knew? Depressed, you just burnt your life to the ground, you hate yourself. Have some Yahoo and AA come up to you and say, has anybody told you they love you today? Oh, God, get away from you. You know a hug's coming. Stop it. Don't do that. Don't touch me. So when you get to a place, the book refers to it, the jumping off place, and we'll wish for the end. And I was on that bridge. I was on a bridge trying to get up enough courage to kill myself. And this terror gripped me. And truly, it was not a fear of dying. That's not it at all. The fear was that this isn't high enough. And I've had such bad luck for so long that I probably won't die. I'll probably end up paralyzed from the neck down, and I'll lay in some charity ward for 50 years. And nobody will bring me a drink. And my head will just you know, the memories that just make you want to kill yourself all over again. The shame and the remorse. And I'm stuck. Locked up, a prisoner up inside of me, and I'll lay there like that for 50 years. I broke down on that bridge. I started sobbing. And I'll tell you, I suspect that if there had been a plaque on that bridge that said 100 people, 100% of the people who jumped from this spot are dead, I'd have been in the air. But I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of going on the way I'm going on. And that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization occurs in guys that are living on the streets, and it occurs in people in $15 million homes who eventually stick a pistol to their head and blow their brains out. People who have everything. Because the bottom is not external, it's internal. It's a place where there's no friendly direction. As the book says, you get to a place where there's nothing left. Before you ever believe in AA, before you ever believe there's a God, before you ever believe in a sponsor, before you ever believe in any of that stuff, it says you'll come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of your life as you've been living it. And man, I believe that. And I ended up off that. I came off that bridge, and through a bizarre series of circumstances, I was trying to go to Southern California. I thought I could survive another winter, because I almost froze to death on a couple occasions back northeast. I thought maybe if I get to California, I could get some phony ID. The cop, they won't put me in prison. I can build a life for myself. And I never made it to California. I made it to Las Vegas. Didn't want to get to Las Vegas. Matter of fact, in treatment in Pennsylvania, if the counselor would have said, pick 100 cities you might eventually get sober in, Vegas would not have been on that list. But I believe we are brought together by divine appointment. And we end up exactly, as the Buddhists say, when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And when the student's ready, he finds himself in the place where the teachers show up. And I was in a detox in Las Vegas, and a man named Dick Toussaint and all his minions brought meetings in there twice a week. And he was a doer, and he was a 5%er. And when I say 5%er, I mean that I heard a trustee say this in 1980 in my first General Service Area conference. He said that he believed that 5% of the fellowship did 95% of the service in 12-step work. And then he went on to say that 5%, as long as they remained that 5% and didn't get entitlement and stop doing it, as long as they kept doing it, they never drank again. And my first sponsor was a 5%er. My current sponsor is a 5%er, even though he's getting old. And I had dinner with him Wednesday night. I spoke at his home group, and I had dinner with him before the meeting. It was his lights. He's one of the brightest lights I've ever seen. Funniest, abrupt, principled. He's given his life to Alcoholics Anonymous, and his light's dimming. And it is a sad thing for me. A very sad thing. And my first sponsor was also like that. Had a great sense of humor. I've had sponsors that would just pick on me mercilessly. Just, you know, make fun of me publicly, mercilessly, until I could start making fun of myself. I remember being out to dinner with my first sponsor. And we're at a big table in a restaurant. There must have been, I don't know, 15 people there probably. And the waitress comes and says, "Do you want separate checks?" And he said, "Yeah, give everybody separate checks." She said, "Do you want one check or separate checks?" And he said, "Oh, we can put it all on one check." And he looks at me and says, "We're honest here." And then he looked at me and said, "Yeah, you better give him a separate check." And everybody started laughing at the table except me. He's hilarious. And he taught me how to be a servant in Alcoholics Anonymous. He pushed me to take the actions of self-forgetting. You know, Bill Wilson says something in his story. He talks about if the alcoholic will fail to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through two things, and it's not what you'd think. It's not through prayer and meditation. You'd think it would be that. Perfecting and enlarging your spiritual life, you'd think it would be that, wouldn't it? Bill says it's through self-sacrifice and constant thought of others, their needs, and how we can work for them. Constant. And I had a sponsor that just pushed me into 12-step work. I mean, pushed me. And I'd had a lot of therapy. I actually worked as a counselor for a period of time. And wasn't quite sober, but I was. I got away with it for a little while. And he kept pushing me. We went to 12-step work. Hospitals and institutions. I want you to go here and do meetings with those guys and go over here and in the prison and go sign up for that and do this and this. And I, you know, he's help people. So I said to him, in the beginning, I know what you're saying, but, you know, don't you think I should work on me for a while? Because I did a lot of therapy. Did it work on me? He gets this weird look and he rears back, work on you? You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And I thought, you know, I have done a lot of that. If I could have been fixed, you'd think I'd have been fixed by now. I primal screamed, rational emotive therapy with Ellis himself, gestalt therapy, Harris. I went to workshops with Harris at AHP, Rollo May. I mean, I tell you, if it could have fixed, I took a run at everything. And the more I tried to fix myself, the sicker I got. And the more I tried to study myself with the help of psychiatrists and psychologists, the more lost I was. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know who I am. And I'm sitting in meetings, and plumbers and carpenters, we're not talking about people with doctorate degrees in psychology, just everyday people are sharing about themselves, and you're slowly introducing me to me. As I sat there and I would start nodding my head and thinking, my God, I'm like that. And it's not like I just became like that. I've been like that all my life, but I couldn't see it until I saw it and heard it in you. And you introduced me to me. And you nudged me and pushed me into working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is really designed to reduce the separation between me and you and me and God. My grand sponsor, Chuck, used to say there's one problem and it contains all problems, and that's conscious and unconscious separation. The alcoholic knows a loneliness such as few do. And our book says at the root of that is selfishness and self-centeredness. And that is absolutely the truth for me. The problem why I feel so distant and apart from you is I got too much of me between me and you. And the reason I'm too distant from God is I got too much of me between me and God. And I think in some weird way I got too much of me between me and life itself. That's why alcoholics of my type, we don't live much here now. We live here in Bob Bob land. And you guys have you've started to set me free through the steps. And I started to reduce this judgment machine that is the ego, especially in the resentment section. When I did this was our course, the whole world changed. And people do the fourth step and they miss that. It's the most, as a matter of fact, it tells you for a whole page, this stuff's killing you. And what do you do? You can't. What are you going to do? You can't wish away any more alcohol. Because the knowledge that you have resentments and the knowledge that it's killing you doesn't change it. It says this was our course. I'm not going to tell you what that says. But when I did the two things that in that part of that resentment inventory changed my life. I've never been the same. And if you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is a strange place. we know more about you than you do. And I don't say that out of arrogance. I really don't. We know more about you than you do. And you're not going to... We know stuff about you you're not going to know until we tell you. If you're brand new, I can just tell you some... I don't even know who you are. I'll tell you a couple things right off the bat. It's been a bad year, hasn't it? Yeah. You've had some money problems, haven't you? Yeah, I know, honey. You feel lonely at times, and you don't know why. Because you got a partner, but you don't feel like you don't feel like you fit. You're scared a lot, and you don't know why. Sobriety's not that good for you, is it? But you don't want anybody to know because you want people in aid. You want to fit here. So you pretend. You create the double life. You create the facade. The facade will kill you. Get a sponsor. Be transparent. Be genuine. Don't be anything you're not. And if you're screwed up, be screwed up. Because once you own yourself as is today, you can bring, through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can bring grace into your life and you can change quite a bit here. I've changed a lot here. I didn't do it. You know what I did? I got sick enough to submerge myself into the solution. And the process of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me. And if I lived to be 1,000 years old, I could never repay that. So when someone says, would you come up to Vasilia? Yeah. Would you go down to this and do a new panel at the LVRC? Yeah. Would you listen to a fifth step? Yeah. Would you answer the phone call when your sponsee calls you and you know it's going to start off with, you'll never guess what she did now. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I'll take your call. And I've never had it so good. Thanks for listening.